Hey everyone, it's Kaveh from the House of Pod. If you haven't heard our show before, first of all, shame on you. We have like 3 episodes already, so go listen to those. But if you haven't heard of us before, we're a medical sort of podcast. Today we're going to talk about a couple of things, including if and when and how you should fire your doctor, as well as talk to a special guest by the name of Raja Jagadeesan, who's coming to us from the VA. He's a really smart dude, and we're going to talk to him about intern, resident work hours, the training of residents. We're going to talk about racial inequities in pain management for patients. It's going to be a good show.
The opinions expressed on this podcast are broadcasted for educational and informational purposes only and do not represent the opinions of our employers. These opinions are not intended as a diagnosis, treatment, or as a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Please consult a local physician or other healthcare professional for your specific healthcare and/or medical needs or concerns.
Welcome to the House of Pod. Thanks for coming back to join us for another episode. I'm Kaveh Hoda. I'm a GI doctor.
I'm Lizzie Ross. Oh, I'm giving everyone my last name now. Also a doctor in gastroenterology.
And I am Joe, and I'm not giving out my last name. Darn it.
Smart.
Not on this episode, but on others. So if you'd like to find out, please listen to the other episodes.
Blowing my cover again, Lizzie.
How's everyone? How's everyone doing? And I mean us. I don't mean like the world in general. Right. How are the three of us doing?
We are doing well. Thanks for asking us.
I'm feeling a little feisty, actually.
Oh my God. It's because he thinks that his job is in jeopardy.
I feel like I'm being motivated with fear. You're and intimidation. And I don't appreciate it.
Joe's saying that because we now have more than one producer on the show. Joe is kind of our sound engineer, editor, executive producer.
And co-host? He's co-host. Everything. Yeah. He wants more and more power.
I know. I understand that. I actually kind of appreciate that about him. I like seeing motivation in Joe. I love it.
It is. You've actually been editing so quickly. And it's just, I think you should take a step back and just the fact that all these people are excited about what we're doing is really, it's very sweet.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
That's how you should think about it.
Yeah. Thanks for everyone who's given us feedback so far. We appreciate it.
Yeah.
I'm going to try and use it.
So I had an interesting evening last night.
Please, go
I want to talk to you guys. I was having dinner and drinks with a friend nearby, and one gentleman who's sort of a friend of a friend, one guy was talking about how, essentially asking me and my friend Sherry, who's another doctor, about really breaking up with his doctor. It was really interesting. Huh. He had surgery. He didn't love the outcome, and we can go into details if we need to. And he needs sort of a revision. He thinks he needs a revision. And he's asking us, what do you think? Do you think that I should go with another doctor? Or do you feel like I should just stick with her because I'm going to piss her off or piss her colleagues off? Because he's has one insurer and he's sort of stuck there. And he's just asking us what we think. And I thought it was a fascinating kind of conversation.
Yeah, that's a good one. Actually, Joe, let me ask you first, being a non-doctor. Have you had an experience where you've had a doctor and you're just like, me and this guy, we don't have a good relationship. We're not seeing eye to eye. I need a new doctor. Has that happened to you before?
Sure.
Why is it because you didn't have faith in the doctor's abilities, or is it because you just didn't like your relationship or you didn't like the person?
A couple things. So one, I felt the doctor wasn't listening to me.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, and it was also a confidence in his competence.
Uh-huh.
And I actually have an example where the doctor actually was wrong, and uh-huh. he wasn't listening to me. So
because he wasn't listening to what you said, and because of that, he gave you some bad medical
advice. No, I actually had a mole on the back of my back, which I was asking him to please remove.
Uh-huh.
Because my mother and her brother both had melanoma, and my mom was just like, you got to get that removed because we know what they look like.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, no, we're just going to go ahead and watch it over time. And I just said, hey, doc, just we're removing it, period.
Look at you, Joe. Authority.
Literally, that's almost what I said.
Literally.
Joe has a hard time with the word literally.
Yes, mm-hmm. I do. So it turns out we had it removed, and it was precancerous, and mm-hmm. they had to go back in and take about a inch and a half.
To get the margins.
To get whatever. So
yeah.
So yeah, it's competence and listening. And I understand on the doctor's end, you don't want a patient who's gonna tell them how to do their job. But this particular doctor was maybe a little too relaxed, I felt.
Yeah, we've talked about this before. There's a fine line, and there has to be a balance between a doctor who can say no to a patient, because sometimes it's better for the patient to not have a test done, and a doctor who listens to a patient, understands their concerns, and is receptive to that.
Yeah. I mean, this guy, this friend, he was just saying how this surgeon didn't want to do an ultrasound or didn't want to do this and that because it would cost too much money. And, you know, my friend and I were saying, I don't really think that that's necessarily the driving force. But when people are told no, they walk away and think, oh, they just don't want to spend money on me. I think a lot of times, because why else wouldn't you want to do a procedure, a test, and you know, a radiology examination? And that's how he was feeling. And you know, she and I just told him several times, essentially, if you don't feel like you guys have a good relationship or her competence, whatever the issue is, this is your healthcare. You are allowed to break up with your doctor. And we were talking about how to do it, like email her, you know, I trust your judgment. I think you're probably excellent, but at this point, I'd just have more confidence if I could see someone else, or you just go behind her back and call their office and say, I want a second opinion. I think both approaches are fine. If you don't feel like you're getting what you need, you know, do that, as opposed to start talking about, you know, he started talking about documenting what he wants and what he thinks he has so he could have like legal evidence, you know, for future lawsuits. And I'm like, let's, and obviously I'm biased, but I'm like, let's not go that route. Why don't you just get a second opinion? Yeah. Maybe everything she's done is perfectly right. Like,
right.
You know, it was really interesting.
Yeah, no, I mean, if the relationship becomes adversarial, there's certainly no point in continuing it.
Yeah,
you know?
And as a doctor, I mean, I have patients who I don't feel like I'm clicking with them.
Yeah.
And if I get many, many emails that suggest that they're getting angry or litigious, I'll just say, you know, you sound really frustrated. Do you want to see another colleague of mine? I don't see any harm in getting a second opinion. And I do it in a way that I think is kind and fair, and then if they don't want to come back to me, I'm sort of maybe tiny bit excited if we've been fighting.
And also, I would say this, sometimes you're going to get to a point with a patient where you've done everything you can think of, and it's a good idea to get someone else on board just for that purpose alone. It's always good to have a second set of eyes.
Yeah, it makes me feel more confident in my decision, or just makes me feel like I've made them happier as well. So I don't see a huge downside.
So that's what you told the guy?
I definitely told him, Sherry and I both said, 100% do not go back to her. Everything you've said, you have no confidence in her interpersonal and or, you know, surgical skills, don't. And how you do it is up to you,
right?
But don't go back to her.
Yeah.
Because you're going to go in to this surgery or this office appointment and not trust anything she says. Why put yourself in that situation?
Yeah. Yeah.
And that was it. That was interesting.
All right. Very good. So we have a lot to do today.
We do.
We have a special guest, and we're going to introduce this special guest in just a minute. But before we do, let me just throw out again the email address. If you have any questions, it's hopquestions@gmail. That's hopquestions@gmail. And our number is 408-444-6623. If you don't want us to use your real name in either the email or the voicemail, you can give us a fake name, or in the email, you can just ask us to use a different name. We'll happily make up one for you. Anyways, we're going to take a short break. We'll be right back with our guest. Welcome back to the House of Pod. We're very excited to have our next guest. He's a good friend of mine. His name is Raja Jagadeesan, MD, MPH, MS, FACP, PIMP. He is the Associate Chief of Staff of Education at the Sacramento VA. Only one of those isn't correct. And he's also the Assistant Chief of Medicine there, and he is the Chief of Hospital Medicine. Raja, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, guys. That was a... No one's ever introduced me like that.
It's a mouthful.
My wife doesn't know half those things.
It's impressive. We have your CV, and it is daunting.
Right. It's not like Kaveh memorized that or actually knew any of that information. Or we don't even know what half that crap stands for.
No, I knew he was a PIMP.
Thanks.
That I knew.
Again, my wife does not know half these things.
So, man, thanks for coming down.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Let's start with this. Pretty basic thing. Well, maybe not so basic. Explain what it is that, what is a hospitalist? Let's start with that.
Sure. Yeah, you know, I always struggle to come up with the right metaphors when I talk to kind of just like people in everyday life. You know, my hairdresser. by that, I mean my...
His hair is beautifully coiffed, I should say. $8
clips cut that I got last week.
You're a manscaper?
I don't live in San Francisco anymore.
Oh, yeah, sorry, my bad.
You know, they always ask me, like, so what do you do? And I'm a doctor. Like, what are you a surgeon? You know, because, right, because, you know.
Because you're Indian?
Right. No, that would be cardiologist.
Right.
Right.
So, you know, the best analogy that I often come up with is, do you ever watch House? I mean, it's kind of the closest thing to what I do is people get sick. They come in the hospital. They have whatever's making them sick. And then our job is to figure out what it is and treat them.
And you're as brilliant.
I don't know about that, but
Lori.
I also say, because I do, you know, I do a lot of education. So I have like, you know, teaching teams, residents, interns, and so on. There's always kind of all these little underlings that kind of like actually do the work.
Yeah.
Because I'm totally spoiled and I can tell them, mm-hmm. like House, well, mm-hmm. I just go off in my office and
drink.
See the results.
Yeah.
We talked about this before, but which do you think House is a more accurate depiction of medical life?
Ask him which show of our generation, you know, obviously starting in the, I guess, mostly 80s, 90s, current. What medical show have you seen that you think best reflects a medicine doctor? Because you are a we all did medicine training, Kaveh and I, and then we went on to do GI. And Raja just
did you say all?
Oh,
except for Joe.
Sorry.
Joe did other fun stuff. Joe lived his 20s.
He did medicine by osmosis, is how we'll call it.
Having been a fan of the podcast, I will tell you, I think Joe's the most important person on the podcast.
We all agree.
No, I'm serious.
We can say that, but not in front of him.
Oh, that's true.
I think I like
it's true.
Raja a lot.
You know, doctors, like, we get so into our doctor world and we kind of talk in doctorese. And I think it's important to realize that, like, you know, Joe is like the most important person in the podcast, because otherwise this would be the most boring podcast that doesn't relate to like real life.
Oh boy.
Young man.
It's on now. It's on.
Young man, you know where the door is.
Let's get to the hard questions.
Oh gosh.
Wait, so anyway. So which show? Let's get back.
Okay, all right. The caveat being I tend to bounce off medical shows after a while. I would say Scrubs.
Oh my God, you listened to the podcast before. You listened to prior episodes.
There's only one episode on iTunes.
There's only one episode. At the time of this recording, there's only been one.
So
he hasn't.
So
is that
not
the correct answer, ding, ding, ding? No,
yeah,
seriously, I think Scrubs.
That is the correct answer.
Yeah. No, Scrubs is like, you know, I think it doesn't capture the technical reality, but it captures the pathos of what it means to go through this ridiculous, way too long training process, and you have to laugh at yourself at some point, otherwise you will probably cry.
And we also talked about how it really distinguishes, you know, emergency medicine from surgery, from internal medicine, in a way that the other shows sort of blend in this incredibly fictional, fantastical way, you know?
That's true.
So, you work at the VA.
I do.
So tell us, you've worked at other places, you worked at Stanford, for example. Tell us sort of the difference in the patient population there at the VA. And whoever's phone that is, it's going to get chucked out the window. All right, Joe.
That was actually the most interesting man's phone.
You're right. The most interesting man in the podcast.
And Joe just said it was on vibrate. How did that happen?
Anyways, so tell us a little bit about the patient population at the VA, and tell us about what makes them sort of a special population.
All right. So I told myself I was going to do this, even though I'm sure you do at the beginning of the podcast, that anything that I say today is purely my own opinion. So I'm definitely representing my own opinions and not those of my employer, which happens to be the federal government. No, I love working at the VA. I always have. I've been at various VAs through the course of all of us have had long training careers.
Yeah.
You know, med school and residency, internship, et cetera, et cetera. I love working with veterans, and I think one nice thing is there is a sense of purpose and mission, I think, to the work that happens at VAs. And I think it's not just, it's the doctors, the nurses, all the way down to the volunteer that greets someone at the front desk. I mean, there's a sense that we are really treating America's heroes and people who, you know, maybe they've fallen on hard times, you know, maybe they're older, maybe they don't have as much social support as they used to. But someone's going to be there for them, and that's going to be us.
Holy shit, he's good.
That was really... I almost cried.
That was good. Can we have, like, patriotic music playing in the background of that?
Did you, honestly...
God bless America.
Did you train during, like, a med school or residency at a place with a VA?
Oh, yeah, everywhere. So I was at Duke for med school, and we had the Durham VA right across the street. I was at Stanford for residency. We had the Palo VA. And the VA is really kind of one of the... One thing that people don't think about is the VA is kind of a critical part of just the infrastructure of how we train people, like doctors, mm-hmm. nurses, everybody yeah. else.
Does every VA across the country have trainees? I don't actually know that.
So I don't know if I could say absolutely for sure yes, but I would... The overwhelming majority do. It's a really satisfying patient by patient to take care of. They are very grateful.
Yeah.
I really do appreciate that.
So along those lines, what are some of the particular or unique problems you deal with in the VA that you don't deal with necessarily at other hospitals? And what are some of the strengths of the VA?
So I actually think in some ways, there's probably a lot of similarities to what we do as to what's happening in, you know, if you go to an academic center or a private center or a Kaiser or a Sutter or Mercy, I think the style of medicine is probably different. I mean, the, I would say the style of medicine that's practiced on some level sometimes aligns with your organizational goals, right? So if you work at a Kaiser, you know, you're a capitated payment system. So the organization gets a certain amount of money for X, Y, and Z. You're going to take care of 8,000 patients that year. And so being kind of cost conscious and seeing, you know, making sure that you're not wasting resources is a thing, right? And that's going to be your financial livelihood. That's not a bad thing. And I think sometimes, maybe in the 80s, it was perceived as a bad thing, but not necessarily, because, you know, one thing we've seen is there's a lot of studies saying that sometimes too much testing can be a bad thing. Mm-hmm. Sometimes too many procedures can be a bad thing, et cetera.
We've talked about that.
Right? That goes back to Joe's question about why everybody doesn't get head-to-toe CAT scans all the time, which is a great question.
Right.
And
right.
it does come up. Often pose more right. problems than solutions.
It's a good question. It's actually in some ways kind of an American question. And that I think goes to a lot of kind of our culture, right? Which is like, there is kind of this more is better thinking, and not just medicine, it's like in life, right? And so I think that if you kind of compare that to a different system where every time you do a procedure, you make money off it, right? Or every time you know, every patient is kind of a revenue center instead of a cost center. Mm-hmm. It's a different style of medicine. Mm-hmm.
And so, the VA is not like that. And no, it's a good infrastructure to practice.
The VA, so I'll speak as a provider for a second. So outside of the 30,000 foot question, I really enjoy practicing at the VA because I find that I don't have to worry about things like, well, if we do more cardiac catheterizations this year, we're going to make more money. Mm-hmm. Like, that's actually not even a thing. Like, it's completely irrelevant. Mm-hmm. In fact, also, if I refer someone to someone else, I'm going to get a referral fee. If I do more X, Y's, and Z's, I'll make more money for myself.
Gotcha. Yeah.
So I think
you can make decisions based on what's best for the patient.
Correct.
And
yes.
This is something we've talked about before. Yeah. Doctors think that they're above anything like that. And I think studies have probably shown that we're not necessarily.
Above being influenced by costs, yeah. pharmaceutical companies, yeah. all that stuff.
And sometimes it's subconscious. I mean, it's not even always like conscious in your mind, but I find that in the VA, I can just do what I think is best for the patient. I mean, I'm a federal employee. You can look up my salary in the internet, you know. It doesn't matter.
We posted it on the Facebook page.
Raja, I've got a question for you. So I've heard complaints from people within the VA or even outside of the VA sort of noticing a kind of a red tape, bureaucratic or inefficient way of doing things within the organization. And do you see that yourself or is that a correct assessment? Can you address that?
You don't like him so much now, do you?
No, I still like you, Joe. I think, what did Joe describe himself in the first episode? As a very intelligent man.
He is.
He's actually asking a very perceptive question. Mm-hmm. All right, wait. Before I start, I should say again, I'm expressing my own opinion, not those of my employers.
the federal government.
The federal government. Mm-hmm. No, I think there's some reality to that. You know, we experience it on our side as well. And, you know, it depends on kind of what frame we're talking about, you know, whether it's contracting or IT or HR or any of the other millions of processes that you'd have in any complex organization. I mean, we have 360,000 employees in our organization. So there's going to be layers of bureaucracy.
Sure.
I mean, there's no way around that, whether you're at Microsoft or IBM or whatever. But, you know, I think some of the things that are perhaps unique to federal service is, you know, when you think about it, like, you know, accountability chains are a little different. So, you know, if you're at your company and you mess up, you know, your boss completely is like, Joe, what the heck is this, right? And you got to fix it or maybe get fired. I don't know. But, you know, in the VA or any federal service, there's a level of
scrutiny.
Yeah, right. I mean, you know, so what one saying that we have is, you know, don't do anything that you don't want to see in the Washington Post the next day, which is this, every federal service says this because that's literally mm-hmm. the ramifications if something goes wrong. Mm-hmm. It is going to be on national news, and it doesn't matter where you are, what level you are, or if you even make $20,000 a year, it doesn't matter. It could happen, and it has happened, right? You think about kind of what makes the news in the last few years. And so then, but then you got to think, but what does that do to an organization? So when that's the ramification at, for anybody at any level that, you know, you could end up on whatever, you know, TV or whatever. It's not, I'm not saying it's a bad thing, but it is a different level of scrutiny than any normal company, right? As with anything that's complex like healthcare, if you looked at any process at your organization, and you started to scrape it away and scrape it away and scrape it away, I'm sure you can think of like 10 things that are probably not the most efficient. Mm-hmm. Perhaps, you know, things that you can think of like, why the heck are we doing it this way? We should really improve this. But most of the time, those things don't end up in the news. I mean, they may end up, you know, whatever, someone's boss, there might be some accountability, there's a financial trail, whatever, whatever. But when it ends, when whatever it is has that level of scrutiny, is easy to start to create a culture, and not just a culture, but actually stultifying, like actually codifying that culture into regulation after regulation after regulation to make sure, God forbid, we don't ever mess this up. We don't ever mess this up, this up, this up, this up, or this up, right? And so then you do that enough layers. Now all of a sudden there's like 18 layers of policies between you and getting something done. And each one of those, by the way, they usually came for a reason. Because someone in St. Louis 23 years ago, there was a case that ended up in the St. Louis Dispatch for whatever, whatever. Yeah. Now there's a new rule.
I mean, it's not only like the publication and the media attention. It's also probably there's one example of a really bad outcome for a patient where it was then published. And then they had to, like you said, codify and create all these hurdles to protect people, which in the end, the more and more hurdles will probably hurt people. And I don't know, I mean, you seem like you have all those degrees after your name, so maybe you're more involved. But in the, like, decade-long
of
my...
That was really embarrassing,
Kavi. Oh, dude, I haven't even started with you yet.
But I'm just saying...
Don't worry about it. It's going to get worse.
Thanks.
Maybe you're high... It seems like you're higher up on the administrative chain than I ever was. But in my decade-long time at NYU as a med student resident fellow at the VA, I never felt like... that I could impact that, you know, and again, it wasn't really my role as a trainee, but I felt like I had no power over some of the bureaucracy. My job was to see patients, take really good care. And if they didn't have access, sometimes I would squeeze them into my personal clinic. But as a single physician, I didn't feel like I was empowered to affect change. So I'm not sure if you feel the same way.
Man, you guys do know that my employer's...
The federal government.
These are my own and not my employer.
Let me ask you this. This might help you frame the answer. Where do you see the VA going in the next 5 to 10 years? And what if you had some more, you know, say over where it was going, what would you like to see change?
Let's see if I can partially answer both of those questions. Mm-hmm. So our outgoing secretary of the VA, Bob McDonald, he one of his big things was, acknowledging the fact that we have all these layers and layers of policies and rules and red tape, as you called it, just do the right thing. In any situation, it's better to do the harder right than the easier wrong. You know, mm-hmm. and even if that means there's some quote unquote rule that you're breaking, if it is the right thing to do, do the right thing. And he really tried to focus on getting us to be a principles-based organization instead of a rules-based organization. So if you know something is right, just do it. Now, that is, I think, that is the way we should be going. I think there are a lot of barriers between here and there. Right. Mm-hmm. So it's easy for us to say, we should be a principles-based organization. You know, Kaveh, when that patient comes, even if there's rule X, Y, and Z between you and doing the right thing, just do the right thing. Mm-hmm. And whatever the fallout is, it'll be fine. But on the other hand, like I said, we also have sayings like, don't do anything, they'll end up in the Washington Post.
Right.
Right. Right. So then we're like, do the right thing, comma, but Breaking a rule might end up getting politicized. And when I say politicized, I don't mean Democrat or Republican. I mean, it is just the fundamental nature that, you know, you work at Kaiser, you know, you have a board of trustees, et cetera. You know, if you worked at Sutter, you'd have stock, I mean, you'd have a board of directors that would eventually lead to stockholders or whatever. Our board of trustees is 535 men and women in Washington, D.C., who each have wildly different opinions. And that is, when I say political, it's not Democrat, it's just literally, that's the nature of what we do. And every few years, that nature changes, sometimes quite radically. So, you know, on the ground level, I think it's nice to say that we should be a principles-based organization, and we should be empowering people at the front line to do the right thing. Because here's the thing, I really believe this. People want to do the right thing. I mean, I have not met anyone in my 8 years at the VA that's like, I'm here to screw some veteran over. Like, that's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, people are there for a reason. They take less pay to work to help veterans. But you know, we have to then help those people in public service. You know, when you get to the front line, like, people really are trying to do the right thing.
Yeah.
But we got to help people actually, like, not get in trouble.
Okay, so last night when we knew that you were coming on the show, we reached out to people to ask them what questions we should ask you and our buddy, our mutual friend, Jesse Paseno, nephrologist extraordinaire. Hi, Jesse. Had a question for you. What's it like to be teaching the next generation of doctors? Has anybody quit? You guys discussed intern hours on the first show, and Raja is on the front lines of this, so maybe he can give a firsthand perspective. Can he explain the recent work hour changes for interns and why they changed recently?
I love teaching. I mean, that's really why I stayed and why I came to the VA. I was the first hospitalist at my VA, and we've built a teaching program. I think people don't always realize. I think we mentioned this a little bit off air, but you know, the VA provides really a fundamental kind of building block for how we train clinicians in this country. So over half of all clinicians, whether that's you're a doctor, nurse, physical therapist, dentist, whatever, you will train at a VA at some point in your life. And so I think people don't realize that we are one of those building blocks of how are we going to train the next generation of doctors. The VA is an absolutely integral part of that. The work hours specifics. So let me take a step back. All right. So you guys know this, but I'll expound a little bit for the listening audience. You know, the kind of history of residents and work hours and why we have them. You know, 50 years ago, you know, they were called residents for a reason, right? They would literally reside in the hospital. You lived in the hospital, right?
Yeah, we definitely have referenced that. I think in just talking about the origin of the name.
House of Pod,
based on the book House of God from 1978. Miserable existence, depressed.
Right.
This guy lived, and I read, but it's fiction, totally. But it's based on facts of living in the hospital and being miserable. So yes, that's where the name residence comes from.
You know, I would say that the last 15 or 20 years, the stepwise progression for medical training in this country has gone from, like, you know, we have no restrictions whatsoever to, like, we're going to start putting some restrictions in to, you know, maybe residents shouldn't work more than 36 hours in a row. Maybe that's a bad idea. Maybe we should not work more than 80 hours in a week. And then maybe we should make it 30 hours in a row. Maybe we should make it 28 hours in a row.
We've probably gone
a lot of going
too far.
Back and forth. I mean, just me hearing this, someone kind of outside of how this works, and I'm just hearing things here. To me, it's very simple, but I'm not sure why it's kind of been so arguable for such a long time. But if someone's working more than 14 hours, to me, there's definitely going to be a possibility of a bad outcome.
You're totally right. Let me first, and I'm not going to argue for longer work hours for residents or interns, but just let me give you a little bit of the argument as to why some people would say it's an important thing. One, it's important for a young intern to see the disease progress. Right now, it's kind of a little more shift work based for these people. They see the patient, they take care of them for a certain point, then they sign the patient out to someone else and they leave. So they don't necessarily see the progression of the disease, or they don't do those sort of the nitty gritty of taking care of a patient in the middle of the night, which is small and annoying and painful, but sort of important at the same time for the overall learning process. Now, I'm not arguing for that. I'm just giving you, Joe, a little bit of the background as to why.
No, that's interesting. I never heard that.
And there's probably also a little bit of it where it's like, we train like this, you need to train like this. That is a bit.
Yeah. Right. There's a little bit of the kids these days kind of thing. But there's two components. There's an educational component, but there's also an emotional investment that you get. Because if you're there for 24 hours, you see the patient, you probably see a family member, you're probably going to have to talk to nurses, like mm-hmm. I said, pharmacists. There is, and you're totally invested. You know, if you go home and then you come back the next day, you say, what happened to that patient? And if it's shift work, and this is not really, I don't know that we can monitor this or, you know, make it a data point, but it's, there is that emotional investment. When friends tell me, Kaveh tells me, I went in last night and I'll talk to him the next day. I'll be like, what happened to that guy? You know, you hear about it because right. I care about Kaveh's experience, you know, and there's that component as well. But when a patient sees the same doctor over and over, yeah. they like it.
Sure,
and when
sure.
I meet someone and they've been through the ER, met a hospitalist, met this and that, and I'm like, I'm your GI doctor. They're like, don't even tell me your name. I've met like 15 people sure. today. And they seem really exasperated mm, yeah. and they seem really warm right. and so touched when there's a consistency, a continuity, we call
but,
it.
But I get what Joe is saying. You don't want someone who looks exhausted in their 36th hour of being up to do anything like put an IV into you or anything
exactly.
like that.
Or more, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, because you're so involved with teaching and in training, you know, we see that more and more doctors are opting to not go the clinical medicine route, mm-hmm. especially here in Silicon Valley. We're seeing a lot of people do startups and that sort of thing.
You're saying get their MD and then go
exactly.
elsewhere.
Exactly. And do something else with it. Work for a pharma company or technology, start an app or something along those lines. Are you seeing that with the people you're teaching? And is this something that training is going to sort of address?
Well, I want to hear how many people get fired and or quit, but that's also a good question because there may be directly related.
Get fired and or quit from?
Like residency, because then they end up in pharma. They end up in, you know, doing their startups and stuff like that.
I see.
Or maybe because they don't know that they really don't like it. Though yeah, there are yeah. people who do their 4 years of medical school and then go straight into industry. And then I think there are people who do residency and really, because that's when you learn what medicine yeah. really is about, the lifestyle, and they just either quit, get fired, and then they go into industry. So there's yeah. all these different routes, right? Yeah.
No, you guys are totally right. One, you know, some things that I've noticed, some of this is anecdotal, but some of this is also from kind of, you know, as I go to our national conference and training and stuff. It's very variable. You know, when I was at Duke, there was a certain culture. I think when I was at Stanford, there's a different culture. When I'm at UC Davis, there's a different culture. You know, Kaveh, you're so right. When I was at Stanford,
usually
I would.
We're gonna bottle
once in a while.
Just trying to
cut that and just put that on repeat.
We're trying to bottle that feeling that he has. it's called gloating.
Yeah, right. I'll do it again. Kaveh, you're so right.
Never gets old.
You know, at Stanford, you're right. I mean, the people, there's so many different options and people come with a lot more varied interests, perhaps, mm-hmm. than in decades past, yeah. right? They want to, they have a biotech on the side, a device that they're making or whatever, mm-hmm. and half the kids that I trained with aren't actually seeing patients very much nowadays. Yeah. UC Davis is different, you know, and again, every school, every training modality is very different. You know, at UC, it's a UC. I mean, mm-hmm. it's University of California, and there is an intention, and it comes from the top all the way down to the training systems. We are trying to train doctors for California. Mm-hmm. And if you want to go into primary care, that's not a bad thing. That's a good thing. I mean, we actually want people who really want to take care of patients yeah. when they grow up and become real doctors. But that being said, I think the national trends from what I have seen is there is some difficulty in getting people to go into the primary care specialties, which, if you think about it, really should be the foundation of our healthcare system. So if you have a really good primary care doctor and a really good primary care system so that you're getting your immunizations that I know Joe said that he may not like. We'll talk about that later.
No, that's not true. I have nothing against immunizations.
Flu shot, I heard.
Flu shot, though, is the only one along with the vitamin B shot. Other
that's,
than that, I'm all for
it's a whole other vaccine. Podcast. We'll get to that later.
You know the vitamin B shot.
Yeah.
Let's not, oh gosh.
But yeah, four vaccinations, hepatitis B, got it. Even though I'm yes. not around blood at all.
Yes.
Why not?
Take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll talk about some other stuff. Roger, you stick around?
Sure, it'll be great.
All right, we'll be right back.
Well, welcome back to the House of Pod. We're going to go to an email. We got one of our first emails, very exciting, recently, by Shaheen, a lawyer, I believe, who just is obviously very insightful and sent us a couple questions.
Quick note about Shaheen. You guys may have seen he was in a viral video not too long ago. You may have seen this viral video of this guy who's answering the door for kids at Halloween, and he's just chucking candy out into the street, and
that's
it went
him?
Like viral. That's him.
On our show?
Yeah.
Wait, into the street so that the kids would chase it and get hit by a car?
No. I mean, like, into, like, the front yard.
Got, like, a
his
million
arm
or
isn't
two
that
hits.
Good. Yeah, it got, like, a... It was huge.
That's his awesome. Arm isn't that good.
That's who's writing this email, just so you know.
Oh, I had no idea. Yeah. He was famous.
Yeah.
The email is as follows. Hey, HOP. This study published in 2016 states racism in medicine has negative health effects on Black and Latino patients. Do they have critical race theory courses in medical school? Should they? In what way has medicine changed? In what ways should it? That's an excellent question. So the article that Shaheen is referring to is from, I think, April 2016 in the journal PNAS.
Unfortunately named journal.
Which is PNAS, Proceedings of National Academy of Sciences of the United States of America, which is a peer-reviewed scientific journal. They talk about everything, biology, social kind of aspects of medicine and science. It's, you know, very popular among, like, medicine and science. But I have to say, it's not like I have a subscription or anything like that. So it really just talks about, like you said, pain assessment and how we essentially, as doctors and lay people, they kind of examine both populations, have these false beliefs about specifically Black people. And how it's perceived that they have more pain tolerance than white people. And therefore, treatment and pain medication is administered in different ways between Blacks and whites. And we're essentially under-treating pain, which is really a cruel thing if you think about. And this also extends to kids, which really sort of, I was reading it. I'm like, okay, this sucks. This is horrible. I feel like our society and medicine has done a great disservice. And then when I read about the kids, I was really just like sort of heartbroken to think of like little more ethnic children or Black kids just being deprived in that way. It's really makes it a little bit sadder for some reason.
So yeah, this is an interesting article and an interesting email. And it's not really a new concept. We've known for years that there is this sort of disparity in treatment for pain between different races. And some people say it might be insurance coverage, and maybe there's a greater reluctance to take opioids, even if they're given in certain cultures. But definitely there is some clear evidence for racial bias and stereotyping as well. So it's just, we've seen it before in like 2005, there was this pediatric journal that showed white children with appendicitis were 3 times more likely to get opioids than Black kids for appendicitis in the emergency room. And at University of Pennsylvania in 2012, Salome Meghani, shout out to my Iranian people, got to get at least a couple of those in each episode. She looked back and used 20 years of data to show that there was a racial disparity amongst different groups, but certainly the most amongst African Americans. And then in 2015, the Journal of Pain showed that pharmacists in white communities were 54 times more likely to carry the appropriate amount of opioids than in pharmacies in Black communities. What's really unique about this study, what makes it a little different, was that there was a link between these false beliefs and also the different treatments or the under-treatments. And we can talk a little bit about why this is happening. I think this is where it gets interesting. You know, medical students, they don't come out of like a factory or a machine. They come from society. Society has a lot of issues.
So it's not med school we're blaming. It's society, well, which I think is both. This study points to both things are true.
It's also med school, right? Because the way we teach race in medicine may not be quite right. So if you talk to a sociologist, and Joe and I have a mutual friend, Ahmed, who's a sociologist, and he keeps telling us race is a social social construct. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, something that pretty much all sociologists believe, or most of them do. And we treat it as there's them being these really innate biological differences between groups of people. And yeah, and there certainly are some small things, right? But we should probably focus maybe a little bit more in teaching and training. And Raja, I'd love to hear your thoughts about this. But we should also sort of focus on racial inequality, maybe being a contributing factor into these health disparities?
Well, I want to hear what Raja says specifically about curriculum, because there are a couple things I don't think in medicine people emphasize. I think race disparities. I think we don't learn anything about business and how to like start a business.
Right.
And we also really don't learn, and maybe it's changing, about like transgender, LGBTQ kind of population. Those are the things. But you say it's known. I had no idea that this existed until I read it. I had no idea. I know that, you know, there's a lot of documentation about Black people having worse access, and there, and we also see in our field in gastroenterology that the risks of the rate of colon cancer is higher, and we have to start screening at a younger population. And again, why that is, we don't know. If it is a biology, if it is access, we don't know that stuff. So I know a lot of disparities, but I didn't know about pain assessment and treatment.
I feel like every couple of years, something like this comes out.
Yeah.
And then we're like, oh, that's really bad. And then nothing happens. And then like yeah. another article comes out like 10, 5 years right. later, something like that.
And we do need to start with curriculum. So I don't know if you have any thoughts or if you're involved in med school curriculum.
Yeah. You know, I saw this article as well. It is very interesting. I think so, kind of the 1,000-foot level and then the 30,000-foot level on this. You know, the article itself, it's very nuanced, but it kind of has to be. And so if you look at kind of how they ask the questions, so, you know, they had this list of 15 questions, by the way, four of which actually were true and the other 11 were false. Mm-hmm. And so they're trying to see, like, do med students or residents or whatever have any of these false beliefs? And you're right. One of them was black skin is thicker than white skin. But there were some tough ones. There's like, you know, black people's blood coagulates more quickly than white people's. And, you know, as a med student, you know, there's, it's like, what's the Greek word for sophomore? You know, wise idiot, right? Mm-hmm. Sophomore, right? You know, so in med school, you might learn a fact like, oh, hemophilia is more likely in white people than black. Mm-hmm. And then someone gives you a multiple choice question and you might say, oh, I don't know, this sounds reasonable. Maybe black people's blood coagulates more quickly or whatever. Now, is that a racist belief?
Well, it's not necessarily about being racist. It's about being
right.
false.
Right. Good. So and that's what I think. So, and they even specifically say in this article, like, you know, they actually specifically asked, were there pro-white opinions or racist opinions?
Yeah.
And there weren't. So it's not like, you know, young doctors are like overtly racist,
yeah.
feeling that way, acting that way. And I think that era has kind of passed. It's a tough question. I'm looking at some of these, like, blacks are better at detecting movement than whites. Like, you're thinking, like, what is that?
That's
even
like a jiu-jitsu question.
Like,
but I think
like they're superheroes or they're X-Men or something.
Right, exactly.
Right. No, so actually, I'm glad you said that, right? Because, okay, again, my personal beliefs, not the beliefs of my employer. But I mean, think about it. Like,
he
you know,
says that just like in normal discussions, right. just so you know. Like, we'll be out on the street and I'll be like, hey, Roger, what do you want to eat? Okay, just my personal belief, not the federal government, but I would like a steak. Like,
yeah. Do you like
I'm
these?
Not endorsing fatty foods.
I mean, sociology is not a bad thing to include into some sort of medical training. I think
yeah.
that's a big part of what we do. We just don't even know it.
Yeah.
I mean,
everyone needs to train at like a city county hospital because you see yeah. such a variety of people, blacks, yeah. whites. I saw a ton of Bengali, you know, Russian, Polish, every, you know, a ton of Chinese people in New York as well. And everyone really, if you have such a huge volume of different ethnicities, mm-hmm. you can't start confining yourself yeah. to like racial stereotyping. I mean, of course, there's got to be some of that. Like you said, a lot of this is subconscious and where you come from. But if you see such a variety of people, you can't start just pinning everyone down to their one racial kind of disease or yeah. construct.
Right.
You know, okay, I don't want to go too down the affirmative action well, but I will say that I think it also helps when your compatriots and your peers reflect a diverse population as well.
Yeah.
Because, you know, as a society, like if you grew up in a certain kind of environment that was all you were exposed to, you went to high school or college or whatever, like you said, they're just Americans, right?
Yeah.
These, I mean, not like doctors is anything special, but I think there's some value to being exposed to when the person to your right is an African American trainee, the person to your left is an Asian American trainee,
yeah.
the person behind you is an LGBT, you know, trainee. And then it humanizes all of them, right? Mm-hmm. And you're like, oh, then you would see that and be like, that's ridiculous. That it, of course there's no difference between, I mean, I know her and like, that would be, but you know, we all come from different sheltered areas, right? And so I do think there's some value, I think, in having some of that kind of diversity in your compatriots and trainees.
Yeah, I mean, certainly I think people probably inherently, without even thinking about it, have an easier time treating people that they relate to or they look like them or whatever. And unfortunately, like only 5% of doctors in the United States are African American.
Right.
So that's a small amount, really. I mean, it doesn't represent what we have out there. And hopefully that's changing. But yeah, it makes sense. The more diversity we have as a field, the better we can treat patients.
The problem with this segment is that Joe hasn't spoken at all.
Joe's afraid to speak on this one.
I'm not afraid to speak.
He is. Because
he's the whitest one here.
No, it's a good... the data is scary to hear. It is. Like, kind of Lizzie was a little shocked. I am too. And if the data is saying that minorities are not getting the same care as another group, you know, I think the biggest focus before you do anything is, well, what's the why behind it? And we've been talking about the different reasons. It's not necessarily malicious thinking. It's just maybe some false myths that the doctors have been, you know, accustomed to for years.
And maybe it's just communication. Maybe, like you're saying, if most of the doctors are Jew, Persian, and Indian sitting representing it at this table.
We are so stereotypical.
Yeah, we are. If most of the doctors reflect that, and then you have a black person in the emergency room, maybe there's just a communication barrier. Maybe a black patient can't communicate as well to a white doctor the pain that they're suffering. And I mean, the worst part about this article, not only the inherent possible racism, is that pain is considered a vital sign. It is the last vital sign, you know, and to think of people suffering, you know, when they're trying to seek, you know, help is just really sad, whether it's any race, ethnicity.
Yeah, it's appalling to hear that. And I think I'm on the same page as Raja as far as, like, it has to change and everybody here. I wouldn't go down the affirmative action route, though. At least not in today's world, because I think it can actually, first of all, I think it's a good thing to have diversity, whether it's in the medical field or any business organization. But affirmative action is a little different because it's holding certain ethnicities to a lower standard. And I think it's actually kind of racist towards those minorities, to me. If I was on that,
this is very inflammatory.
Oh my God, this is a big subject. Are we ready to do this?
The presumption is they're equal candidates.
No, but I'm serious. I think it causes more bitterness within the team
among white people. Bitterness among white people.
I think it's bad for
the presumption is.
Hold on, Lizzie.
Hold on.
I love it.
I'm just saying. It's if I were a black person, I might be a little sensitive to the fact that people are saying, well, he just got hired because of affirmative action, or they're going to hold me to a lower standard than somebody else just because of my race.
Yeah, that's not how it works, though.
Should work.
The African-American guy who gets in to say if there was an affirmative action program that got a black guy into a medical school, they didn't get him in because his grades were lower. He didn't get any sort of breaks. His grades are just as good as the white guys that are there. We're looking specifically to diversify the population. So nobody gets into med school. Nobody gets into any of these programs not deserving it. They still deserve it. Right. They're just trying to specifically create a diverse group,
it's forcing it, though. It's not based on...
No, he's saying that everything is the same. He's saying everything...
based on race specifically.
He said because everything else is the same. So you need to choose one person over another. And like Raja's saying, we do need to be more diverse as our career, you know, as professionals, as a culture, and we need to reflect that. So if everything else is the same, you should choose the black person because they are underrepresented among medical professionals.
And I think it's a common misperception about affirmative action that those people getting in for that reason are unqualified or underqualified in any way. They still have to meet the qualifications. And trust me, there's plenty of people from every group that do, and it's just about making space for them. Anyways, Lizzie is done with this. Okay. All right. Well, I think we've given the people plenty of show for today. Thank you so much, Raja, for coming. That was a ton of fun to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
I hope we have you back again. Raja Jagadeesan, great guy. Great guy to have on your squad if you're playing a first-person shooter.
That's true. The next time we see the VA in the Washington Post, we're gonna ring you up.
We're going to be looking your name.
Look forward
your
to
name
it.
Every time. Again, one more shout-out for our email, hopquestions@gmail.com. Let us know if you want us to use your real name or not. And if you want to call, 408-444-6623. Thank you guys again for listening. See you next week.
Bye.
All anecdotes and patient-related details were changed with respect to date, sex, and certain details so that patient identification is not possible.